And welcome to A Chat in the Garden with Monique A.J. Smith, where Smith and Booms in athletics and sports. Well, spring break is next week. And I have got a very, very busy week, so I won't be doing much spring breaking. I'm blessed to be able to bring my services to Alabama State University. I'm conducting a student-athlete workshop, but my signature workshop that I kind of upgraded from middle school kids to college kids, where it's take the mic, voice over your fears, to lead your fears. And that's what I'll be doing at Alabama State on Monday. On Tuesday, having a connecting event at a very recommended restaurant in Montgomery, Alabama. Looking forward to it. I don't think I've been to Montgomery. So I'm flying into Atlanta and renting a car. And then on Wednesday, I'm going down to Stillman College and celebrating Women's History Month with the female athletes at Stillman. On Thursday, coming back to Atlanta. I am on a podcast Thursday night. It's on Name, Image, and Likeness. I have to post some more information about that. But the podcast is called Name, Image, and Likeness Neo Podcast, so this should be interesting. And then on Friday and Saturday, I'm getting some professional development myself. I'm going to a women's sales conference. And so I won't be having my feet in the sand and on the beach during spring break. I'm going to be working and learning, and that's just the way I like it. WeCoach has partnered with the HBCU High School Unsigned Seniors Showcase, April 23rd at Boo Williams Sportsplex, from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. To provide a pre-event for women coaches in attendance and in celebration of the 50th anniversary of Title IX, WeCoach will have a pre and meet and greet and panel discussion from 12 to 2 at the Boo Williams Sportsplex. This will be in the multipurpose room. And then followed by, we'll begin the Unsigned Senior Showcase. But the Level Up panel will focus on the strategies for coaches to move to their next from club to high school, from high school to college. This event is free to all women basketball coaches, but you must register to attend. And so to do so, you can go to bit.ly/WeCoachLevelUp. And it is case sensitive. So bit.ly/WeCoachLevelUp. We level up. So I'm excited about this partnership. And be really, really excited about seeing the women come out and get some outstanding women in the business to tell them how to level up to their next. So I'm really excited about that. Just excited, honestly. I just really am proud of the connections that happen in this group and how we support each other. And one of those individuals is Dr. Janice Hilliard of Hilliard Solutions. I'm proud to be a gold sponsor of the event, which will be held virtual. So the 5th Annual Virtual Women and Athlete Development Symposium and Networking, because I tell you, I've done some great networking under Dr. Hilliard's platform. She has a way that she has several breaks in her conferences so that you can branch off and go into these little rooms, these little virtual rooms. And I'm telling you, some masterminds will come out of that. So, again, the 5th Annual Virtual Women in Athlete Development Symposium and Networking will take place April 12th and 13th. Tickets are on sale now. Before I tell you how to go purchase a sale, I want to give you a bonus. If you purchase your ticket for this event between the week of March the 7th, that's the week that we're sitting in right now, and you can show me your proof of purchase, I will give you a bonus gift. The bonus gift is a professional development book because I believe all of this comes together. So, again, we have the 5th Annual Virtual Women in Athletics Development Symposium and Network, April 12th to the 13th. To make your purchase, go to HilliardSolutions.com/symposium. HilliardSolutions.com/symposium to make your purchase. And all that leads up to what? Happy International Women's History Day. This is the day. We celebrate the whole month, but today is the day. So I would like to say celebrate by purchasing the 5th issue of Significance in Athletics and Sports. Can you believe we are at number 5? This is something to celebrate, for real, for real. And it's featuring the true trailblazer, Alfreda Goff. Alfreda has helped so many women with business. And really strategic ways. You know, we talked about being sponsors. Being a sponsor is someone speaking your name into rooms when you're not in there. And a positive light for your advancement. And Alfreda Goff has done that tremendously for me. She put me on my very first NCAA committee. I had no clue. I got this big box in the mail. I was on the first Division II nominating committee, which set people up in Division II for all the other committees. And had no clue, and because I had been a sports information director, which they do a lot of ballots, they do a lot of nominating, and do a lot of promoting. And so she said, you'd be very well suited for this position of helping other people get on committees and maybe read and to see who would be good fits. And I was like, oh, okay, I can do that. And that started my committee work history of doing that. I've served on a lot of NCAA committees since that first one. And I have to give credit to Alfreda Goff. And I'm just one of many times many times many who had benefited from Alfreda Goff saying your name in a room. So to learn more about this phenomenal woman, this trailblazer, please get your copy, your 5th issue of Significance in Athletics. She's on the cover. Alfreda Goff is on the cover. You can go purchase it at seedsofempowermentstore.com. Seeds, S-E-E-D-S, of empowermentstore.com, or you can purchase on Amazon. Either way, we just want you to have it in your hand. And if you're so inclined to want to buy it for your student athletes, especially this month of March, give the gift. Give the gift to all your women athletes. Actually see all the possibilities. Most of our student athletes only know of the possibilities of being a coach and athletic trainer. Let's share with them all the other positions that are in athletic administration. Let's plant that seed. So you can also purchase 15 at a time at seedsofempowermentstore.com. Seeds, S-E-E-D-S, of empowermentstore.com. And let's just grow together. Let's grow together. So just a couple of sponsorship announcements. Our CWOW Foundation is offering media training for student athletes with name, image, and likeness on deck. This is such an important training. Candy Waller, the founder of has the founder, has extensive background in seawall sports entertainment. Y'all, she was just at the combine. She was doing her thing. She is truly about getting the word out. But because she's been exposed to that, she sees the need where we need to assist our athletes in their presentation to the media. So she's branching out to prepare our players for lights, camera, action, so we don't have any sorry Miss Jackson moments. For more information, email info@seawallfoundation.org. Again, it's info@seawallfoundation.org. Surviving the Lights, a professional athlete's playbook to avoiding the curse by Tawana Smith, is an excellent resource as it also deals with name, image, and likeness. You'd be really surprised about the different personnel that need to assist athletes when they start getting income. The reason why you need to have this is that now our student athletes can receive income before they become a professional. So some of the ways of how to let down your family members who say, I got you, but you don't know how to say, you may have me, but you don't know all that's in front of us. So Surviving the Lights, a professional athlete's playbook to avoiding the curse by Tawana Smith, is available on Amazon in three different formats, paperback, audio, and ebook. Alva Amaker, educational risk management consultant, on Vigilant Safety Training Center. Her motto is policy to practice. Is that okay to have a wonderful policy manual and no one knows what's in it? So she likes to train from that, and she's very thorough. Whatever state you're in, she's going to do the research to be able to assist your institution into being the best light. And we know that there is trouble in the land almost every week where we hear some type of tragedy as it relates to crowd control, player incidents, just general public pieces. And so she has an assessment where she can help you find the areas where you need to close that gap. And so the center has the following training: first responder training, sport and event staff certification, workspace safety, and personnel training and operations. All of these things are so crucial. And so here's a resource that can help you. Go to vigilancestc.com, Vigilance. STC.com to get more information and get your free assessment to close some of those gaps that could cause you a major issue. Well, the time has come for us to meet our newest guest on the Chat in the Garden podcast. It's a pleasure to bring Dr. Tracy Kennedy, assistant professor at Duke University, in the area of cultural anthropology. Welcome to the garden, Dr. Kennedy.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so I guess you heard your cheers. I heard your chuckles.
I did hear them. Thank you for that.
I've noticed you've been in many a football, but you've never had them cheering for the doc, huh?
No. They don't usually cheer for the professor, so you're right. I appreciate that. You know, I like to hear that. I appreciate it.
You're very, very welcome. Well, I'm really, really excited about having you because your research is so great. But before we jump into that, tell everyone about your journey from college to your current position.
Sure. Thanks for the invitation to come on the podcast, but also to speak about my work and how I've gotten here. I graduated from college. I graduated from Duke, actually, in 2013. And when I graduated, I knew that I wanted to go to grad, and I knew I wanted to get a PhD in anthropology. And that's because of the mentoring that I received while I was an undergrad. I was also a cultural anthropology and Spanish major in college. And so I knew that I was interested in that. And I had already developed an interest in college football because I was doing research on that while I was in college. And so I knew that was something that I wanted to pursue. I figured it would be tough. I figured it would be something that I would have to consistently explain to people, you know, like what it means to get a PhD, what it means to do research, what it means to be an anthropologist, because not all of these things are accessible, and that's not anyone's fault other than the institution, right? Like the institution of academia, I think it's meant to be quite inaccessible, and it's built that way. And so I knew going into it that that was going to be something that I would have to consistently explain, but I was committed to it because I think that anthropology provides a really interesting lens to study the things that I'm interested in, right? And so when I left college, I took a year off and I worked in a dean's office because I thought I would be interested in going into higher education administration. And so I wanted to get a little bit of experience there. And then I went to grad school the year after. I was a grad student in anthropology at the University of Virginia, and so I was in Charlottesville for a while. And if you know anything about what's been happening in Charlottesville, let's say over the past 10 years, like it was an interesting time to be there. And so I completed my graduate training in 2020. So I graduated during the pandemic. What that means for anthropologists, the way that I had to go through grad school and how I filled, it took me 6 years to finish. The way that I filled those 6 years is that I was in classes for 3 years. Anthropologists then take a year, at least a year, to do research. And so I did ethnographic field work for a year. I wrote my dissertation, and then I applied for jobs, and I defended my dissertation, and then I graduated in 2020. And so that's kind of how I got from where I started to graduating during the pandemic, having to figure out what I was going to do, having to see if the institution of higher education was still going to be standing, because, you know, if you remember March 2020, people were a little worried about, like, what COVID would do to universities, you know, like something that's so dependent on being face-to-face, something that has become dependent on, like, a particular type of interaction and transaction almost. And so there was a lot of worry in the world of education about what would happen. But I ended up, my first job out of grad school was with Notre Dame. So I was at the University of Notre Dame for 2 years, 1 year as a postdoc, and then the next year as a faculty member. And then I got hired at Duke, and so I started at Duke oh my goodness, time is not real. I got hired and I started at Duke in July 2022. So I got to come back to the institution where I started. I got to come back home because I'm from North Carolina, and so now I'm, like, essentially down the street from my family. And all of that for me means that I get to be in supportive spaces that are interested in the work that I'm doing, which for me is to be committed to Black athletes on college campuses. I've been fortunate to be hired by universities that have prominent athletics programs, right? Like Notre Dame and Duke are both well known in this space, even if for different sports, but they're both very well known. And so it's been great to be at these institutions, to be able to do the work that I'm doing, to be supported. I would say generally overall, you know, like athletics sometimes has a problem with what I'm doing, or they're a little hesitant sometimes, but, the students are great. The athletes are great. My colleagues are great. And so it's been really nice to be able to do the work that I want to do in these spaces and to be working on the book that I'm working on, which is really where I'm at right now.
Okay. So, you know, I love books. And so be ready to come back to talk about that. But
oh, definitely.
I want to just back up. I just want to back up slightly. What did your parents do?
What did my parents do? So my dad has been in the mortgage business for as long as I can remember. So he's a mortgage broker. And my, like, essentially, like, his side of the family is in real estate. So my grandpa was a, who's a real estate agent, who is also, he also worked in mortgages. So like it's a, I come from a housing family in one respect. And then my mom has a business degree, and she's just, she works in, currently she works in universities with their, as one of the finance people in the department. But they're both like business oriented people. And so when I came to Duke actually as an undergrad, Duke doesn't have a business undergrad major. And that's what I thought I would major in. You know, like that's what I was just interested in doing. I knew I wanted to be a Spanish major because of what I did before coming into college. But I just figured I would be a business major and I would figure something out from that, not exactly knowing, you know, what I wanted to do, but I figured I would just follow in what they did. I have a younger brother who ended up being, he was a computer science major, I think, and he's very techie now. So he's like, he's of a different mind than me for sure. But growing up around people who were, you know, in finance, interested in money, they're not entrepreneurs, but they do deal with money in very real ways. And so, and numbers, they're numbers people. And that's not me at all. But also it's because, you know, where I went to college, like Duke didn't offer that. And so I had to figure something else out when I got there.
So what did your parents say when you wanted to major in anthropology?
They were supportive. They wanted to know what kind of job I could get with it. They wanted to know what it was. And I think that now that I've been in it for about 10 years, or longer than 10 years, you know, like I graduated 10 years ago, but I had to declare a major before that. At this point, they know what I do. They're able to explain it to people. And it's really funny to like hear them explain to people what I do. I really appreciate like the work that they've put in trying to learn what it is that I do. But I also think that that's something that I'm very committed to too, right? Is like making the work that I do and making the work of anthropologists accessible. Because I think that, as I said, like I think that there's a reason why it's often seen as distanced from the people, even though anthropologists work with people. It can be incredibly theoretical. It can be very, like, not only theoretical, but very high theory. It can be completely disconnected from the people that anthropologists work with, because that is, like, that's a hallmark of the discipline, right, is that, like, you work with people. And so that's something that I've been committed to doing in my little corner of the world of anthropology is, you know, writing in a particular way. So like my book, I'm hoping will be written in a way that like my mom will understand what I'm arguing, because like that's a goal of mine, right? Is that she can pick it up and she can understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For the general public. It'll still be published with an academic press, but I want it to be written in a way that the general public can read it, because I think that the work that I do should not be kept just in the academy, right? Like I don't think that only academics can benefit from it. I think that it is something that can and should be read by anyone who has any type of feeling about sport generally, but football specifically, right? I do public writing, so I try to write op-eds. Like that's definitely something that I'm going to do more of as the book is, like as I finish the book and start to not do press for the book, because that's not really what we would call it for academics. But like once I start talking about the book and, you know, trying to sell it, I will definitely start writing many more op-eds than I already do. But like to get in the style of writing these short pieces that can be read, that are can be read wide and can have various audiences. The way that I teach my classes is very much oriented around like how can we take anthropological theories, which might seem like really theoretical, right? Like that might seem way over there, and I have no idea how that applies. But then how can we make that legible to today? To your life, right? Like when I talk to students in my classes, like that's what I'm trying to get them to do, of like, you know, what did you see on social media? What did you see, especially when I teach a sport class? What did you see on ESPN? What did you see during the game last night that relates to these topics that we're talking about in class, which are written by usually anthropologists, but generally like they're social scientists, right? Like anthropologists, sociologists, sometimes I'll have historians, sometimes I will have journalists that I'm assigning. Like, how do we take these topics that we're reading about and make them legible to your life? Anthropology has a lot to offer. I mean, it's incredibly problematic as a discipline, which is a whole other conversation, but it does have a lot to offer. And I want students to see that, and I want students to better understand that and to see that it can be something that can be applied to them, and they can gain some skills from being an anthropologist or being an ethnographer, which is the method that we use, right, like is ethnography. So how can you apply that to your life, even if you don't end up being a professional anthropologist like me, right? Like even if you don't get a PhD in anthropology, why might it be helpful for you to take a class in anthropology? Why might it be helpful for you to understand the ways that these scholars do their work and the ways that they're writing about the things that they're writing about? Because I think that that has some benefits to people that are just going out into the world and trying to understand what's going on around them. You know, like that's at its core, I think that's what anthropologists do very well, is to see what's going on around themselves, to recognize that like they have a place in that and that the way that they're looking at something actually matters. Right? Like I might see a situation completely differently than you, and we might write two completely different books, even if we were in the same place at the same time. And like, there's nothing wrong with that. There's actually a lot to be said about why that happens, right? And so I want students to see the benefits of that. But I think, I don't know, I think the discipline has a long way to go with that. And there's some people that are really committed to that. So I'm trying to, you know, be in conversation and community with them to make these things legible to not only our students that end up in our classes, but also to various publics and various audiences, because I don't think that academic knowledge, I don't think it's beneficial for it to just stay in the academy. I think that we should all have access to it.
I agree 1,000%. I do. And that's why I do the same thing. I take whatever is the vocabulary words we're discussing, and I try to tie it to whatever is on Twitter. I don't do too much Instagram, but whatever is the latest discussion. I said, how do you explain that behavior? And so we did use your podcast that you had, and we were talking about black bodies in football. And so before I go there, though, I do want to give a shout out that when I first heard your area of study, my brain went to Dr. Janita Cole, the president, former president of Spelman, and former president of Bennett. And I was like,
and a very proud
she can go far with this.
Yeah, and a very proud anthropologist, right?
I said, okay, she can go far with this. So I just wanted to plant that seed with you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, for you to say my name in the same sentence as Dr. Cole, like, I'll take it for sure.
Oh, yeah. And so before I get to your research, I do want to say we met at the Black Student Athlete Summit back in May. Why do you think it was important for you to attend that type of professional development event? And what are some other professional development engagements that you attend?
Yeah, so that's that conference is on my circuit of conferences that I often attend. I probably won't go this year, but last year, actually, when I was there, it was in support of the Notre Dame students that were there. And so usually, specifically that conference, I appreciate that conference for what it does for students that attend, because I don't know if there's another space like that that encourages students and athletes to be in attendance, to present in the way that they do, to be in community, to meet each other. You know, like I think that there's a very particular, which is my work, right? I think there's a very particular Black athlete experience in college. And often it's quite insular. They're often isolated from each other, even on the same campus, right? Like depending on what sport you play, you might only talk to the people that play your sport. And so what I appreciate about that conference is that it brings everyone together, right? And it often, the other thing that I appreciate about it is that it encourages the athletes to go to their athletics departments to sponsor them to go, right? Of like, if you are, if you say that you are actually invested in my well-being and my development and my pursuing whatever it is that I want to pursue, if you say that you're actually invested in that, okay, put your money where your mouth is and don't only invest in my bodily production, right? Like don't only invest in my nutrition and my weight training and the drills that I have to do on the field, you know, for me as a football person. Don't only invest in that, but also invest in everything else, right? Like, so if you want me to do these things, like send me to this conference so I can meet other people, so I can network, because it's not often an experience that they get. so that I can meet other faculty members, other staff, other people that are in this space, especially for athletes that are interested in pursuing something like this. I think it's a great space for them. And so that's usually why I go to that conference. And then, like, there are other conferences, you know, like there's a large, like the anthropology organization, like the major anthropology organization, the American Anthropological Association. They have an annual conference that happens in November. The North American Society for the Sociology of Sport, I go to that one, which has been at different times recently just because of the pandemic, but I think that one's usually in November as well. This summer, I'll be going to the Sport Historian Conference, the North America. I'm horrible with these acronyms because they're also similar, but I think it's the North American Society for Sport Historians, something like that. NASH is their acronym.
That sounds
really interesting because they've actually started a caucus for sport anthropologists, and so there's a couple of anthropologists. I mean, there's very few anthropologists of sport. Like, there's a handful of us, probably less than, I mean, I'm sure I'm missing people, but I'd say, like, I can think of a solid 20 of us within all of anthropology that focus solely on sport. And so it's interesting that the sport historians have started a caucus. So we'll go to that. I'm putting some panels together for that in May. Another conference that I go to. Sometimes I'll go to CSRI, so that's the sport, the College Sport Research Institute, I think, at USC. South Carolina. I'm not going to that one this year, but sometimes I'll go to that, right? So, like, I've got, like, a handful of conferences, the Oral History Association, sometimes I'll go to that. I'll probably go this year. There's a handful of conferences that are related to the work that I do in different ways, right? Like, so it could be methodologically, it could be theoretical, it could be geographic, right? Like, the Association of Black Anthropologists, they sometimes put a conference together with other groups in the larger anthropology organization. Like, they'll sometimes form a conference for that. So it just depends on what's happening each year. You know, like, they're not all the same every year. But I do try to stay connected to the different networks that I am a part of. I do try to, when I go to those events, I try to, I'm very committed to mentoring specifically Black women grad students and Black women undergrads. So I try to, you know, meet up with them when I'm there. I try to meet up with people that I'm in conversation with that either I only know virtually, right? Like, especially during the pandemic and graduating during the pandemic, I met a ton of people because so many things were online, right? Like, you go to all the Zoom talks, you go to all of the virtual hangouts, you know, you do all of that stuff. But some of these people I still haven't even met in person. And so now that conferences are opening up a little, I'm feeling a little bit better about going. Like, I definitely mask in all the spaces that I'm in, but I do feel a little bit better about going now. And so now I have the opportunity to meet these people in person, to, I don't know, have writing projects with them, to start conversations about things that we might want to put in action, right? Like, for me, the way that I kind of get to keep my job, right, is the work that I'm doing and eventually getting tenure. And so who can I be in conversation with that has a similar orientation to the work that we're doing, right? Whether it's about sport, whether it's about, like, I'm linked to several groups. So it could be, like, sport people. It could be anthropologists that are working in the U.S., right, which is not, that's not usually common, right? Like, anthropologists often go international. It could be anthropologists who work on race or experiences of Blackness or anti-Blackness, right? Like, so there's a group of them. So it just depends on, you know, like, what kind of project I'm working on at the time. For me, it always does come through football, but the orientation that I have to it, and then that'll kind of depend on where I go for the year, right? Like, who I'm trying to be in conversation with, who I'm trying to meet up with, where I'm trying to present, where I'm trying to spend my energy and time, right? Because time is the one thing that you can't get more of and you can't get back. So I do try to be strategic about where I go. But yeah, there's a long-winded way of saying that conference during the summer, the Black Student Athlete Summit, is, I find it incredibly helpful for students. And so I like to support them going. This past year, Notre Dame sent because I was still at Notre Dame at the time, Notre Dame sent a group of maybe like six or seven. Maybe there were that many of them that went. So we were there together. So that was really cool.
Well, you know, you just gave a whole training on how to network strategically, because you were saying which conferences to go to, why you want to go there, because even if you have to ask for funding, you need to be able to say why you need to go here and for what. And your answer was to support the student athletes, but even from a research standpoint, you were, you researched who was speaking and who you want to be connected to. And that people, older people, I was going to say young people, all those listening, that is how you network. You just don't go into a sea and say, hey, I'm here. Let's exchange business cards or tap whatever it is electronically to connect, because that does not stick. It doesn't stick.
Yeah, you have to make meaningful. So, you have to make meaningful interactions, right? Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to thank you for coming to our 6 a.m. breakfast to meet and to network with us. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, I appreciate the invitation. And for me, because of the work that I do, right, like I am an academic, like straight up an academic. I recognize that that's the, you know, like that's the lane that I'm in, and I'm okay with that. But because of the work that I do and because of who I work with, because of the students that I have, like I do try to expand my networks outside of just those who are traditionally academics, right? Like you could have a PhD, but you're working outside of a university, or you could be a staff, like you could work in on the staff of an athletics department, or you could have an organization like yours. You could be in charge of something, you know? I think it just depends on, as you're saying, like it depends on what you are motivated by and what you're trying to do, on where you need to put yourself and who you need to be in conversation with, right? And so if my motivation is to help, like, I've got several, right? So, like, if I'm writing, my work is in support of specifically Black college football players. That's the research that I do. That's the work that I do. That's the writing that I do. In the classroom, I'm also committed to athletes, right? Like, because I think that they have a very particular experience, and they also often end up in my classes just because of lots of different reasons. So I'm committed to that group in my class. I'm also committed to Black women that come through my class, right? Because if we think of who's marginalized in academic spaces, it's often Black women, specifically in anthropology, right? So if I meet a Black woman who's an anthropology major or minor, like I'm incredibly committed to her experience and trying to help her navigate these spaces, right? Like if you are, marginalized in any way, because structural, like there are tons of populations that are structurally marginalized within the academy. So if you're first generation, if you're native, if you are disabled, if you're, you know, like any of these identities that students often have that are often not treated as something that needs to be acknowledged, or students are trying to compensate for them, overcompensate for them, you know, like whatever the reason is, like I'm trying to address those students because I think that they have a very particular experience and often they are looking for help to navigate their experiences. Sometimes they don't know how to ask, right? And so like because that's who I'm motivated by, that then matters for where I put myself, right, so that I can do my job better to help those populations of students who are undergrads and grad students, also my colleagues who I'm in conversation with, right, like where do I need to be so that our work can be better, so that our work can be published, so that people can understand our work, right, like that's what I'm trying to consistently do, is to make sure that I'm in the right spaces to do my job better, which can then help all of these other groups of people that I'm trying to be in community with. And trying to care for, because they're also trying to care for me. And so it's a mutual thing. And so that's what I'm trying to do. You know, like I could always be better at it, but that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, we always can get better. And I think your striving is a great blueprint. So we're going to take a short break here in Chat the Garden. And when we return, we're going to deep dive into your research.
Hi, I'm Dr. Janice Hilliard, President and CEO of Hilliard Solutions. Are you interested in entering and advancing in the field of athlete development? Then the 5th Annual Women in Athlete Development Symposium and Networking Event on April 12 through 13 is for you. Since 2019, over 45% of attendees are enjoying their dream job in athlete development. Go to HilliardSolutions.com/symposium today for more information. Looking forward to seeing you online.
Hi, my name is Candy Waller, and I'm the president of the Seawall Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit organization established to enhance the transferable skills of student athletes. We are currently launching a media training course to prepare student athletes to effectively engage with the press and the public. To learn more, email us at info@seawallfoundation.org. We look forward to hearing from you soon.
This is Alva Champion Amaker of ANA Athletic Consulting and Vigilant Safety Training Center. My investment to become a member of the Advanced Academy is one of the best decisions I've made in my business and personal growth journey. Working with Monique has provided the network to connect and collaborate with some phenomenal women and leaders, exposed me to literature for growth, and opportunities to share my skill sets and knowledge. Her candid approach in the one-on-one sessions make me more accountable for taking the necessary steps toward my advanced success. Thank you, Monique, and I appreciate you.
Why do colleges support student athletes pursuing every profession except professional sports? Why are they treated as just students when they're athletes, knowing that they need help surviving the lights? I'm Tawana Smith, and as a former Division I and pro athlete and now best-selling author, I've created a transition system specifically for student athletes called Surviving the Lights. For more information, visit www.survivingthelights.com to learn how we can change the game together.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Monique A.J. Smith, here in the Chapter Garden, where significance blooms in athletics and sports. Well, I mentioned that your research on black bodies in football is most interesting and sometimes, to some people, controversial. I made your podcast interview an assignment in my class, and so I guess because I put down here, staying on the career side, are there more of you out there? You already answered the question. You said about 20 sports anthropologists out there. And you already mentioned why the research is important. So just for those who may not, can you recap a little bit about your black bodies and football research for our listeners?
Sure, and I really appreciate you assigning that podcast. It was really fun to be on the Black Athlete podcast with Lou Moore and Derek White. After the reason that they asked me on was because I wrote a piece at the beginning of the year, a public piece at the beginning of the year, about Damar Hamlin's injury and his near-death experience on national television during Monday Night Football, and so that's what I wrote about, and that's what we were talking about on that podcast. The reason that I wrote that piece is because for me it fits into larger arguments that I'm trying to make in my written work that is specifically about college football players, even though Damar Hamlin is an NFL player and that was a Monday Night Football game. But the work that I do and the writing that I do centers on black college football players' experiences. And their experiences, not only of, you know, like the fun stuff that comes with football, of like winning and creating family through it, which is something that I say that they do a little bit differently than how it's often narrated, right? Like not the football family that is branded by programs, but like they create family themselves with fellow black players. It's not all of just that stuff, right? Like not the fun things that come with being in college. But also often like the exploitation that comes with being a part of a college football team, not often, like they are exploited people. So like the experience of labor exploitation and hyper-violence and like being riddled with injuries and having to deal with being a student while also being an athlete, while also being in a cast, while also having to go to training at 6 o'clock in the morning before you go to class, before you go to find something to eat, before you work on the group project, before then you hang out on a Thursday night because, again, you are in college, right? Like, what is that experience and all of that together? How are they navigating that as such young people, you know? How are they experiencing being in bodies that I don't think it'd be possible to really argue against this, like bodies that are built up in a particular way, like they're big, strong, tall, usually guys, right? And these bodies are necessary to play football because you can't be like a small, puny person like me. Like, you can't play football living in that body. The sport itself does not allow for it. And so they have bodies that are built up in particular ways because they need to be that way in order to, one, protect themselves from play, but also to play effectively. But then what happens when you take the pads and helmets off of that, like, literal body and you put it in the college town that your college is in, or you put it in a suit to try to get a job, or you just put it in, like, regular street clothes and you're just, like, walking around at the mall or, like, walking around at Target on the weekend, right? Like, what happens then to that body? How is that body treated and reacted to, right? Like, how is that body policed and surveilled and seen as threatening? And these are all things that we see, again, like, this is coming back to the way that I teach my classes, right? Like, this is something that we see all the time. We see the ways that people interact with specifically Black men, but generally just Black people, right? Like, the ways that they interact with them, the way that they talk about them, the way that they stigmatize them, the way that they're stereotyped. We see all of that. But then what does it mean for, like, a 19-year-old guy who's just playing football? You know, like, something that at some level he does love, even if it has become incredibly commercialized and perhaps not what he was expecting in college. What does it mean for him to be experiencing that, right? Like, to have to figure out how to navigate that experience, to have to deal with all of that in his everyday life. And so those are the questions that I ask in my work and that I write about. And so the reason that I wrote about it in the way that I did in relation to the Damar Hamlin injury is because if we look at the statistics of who plays football, who plays positions in football, who's a coach, who's an owner in the NFL, who's in administration, who's on the staff, if we look at the demographics of all of that, it is very clear that Black men are overrepresented on the field and highly underrepresented in every other position that we could say is a position of power, right? And even if you are paid in the NFL, one, that doesn't mean that you deserve to have your body, to have all these things done to your body, to be like literally almost killed during play, to not be able to access money from concussion settlements because that was happening in the NFL, to be riddled with injuries that once you graduate from college, the college is no longer responsible for, right? So you could be injured in college and they'll take care of it, but the second you graduate, like, they're not paying for you to have surgeries, they're not paying for your rehab, they're not paying for anything else. So what does it mean to have that experience and how do you navigate that? How do you deal with that? And the reason that Damar Hamlin's situation came up is because of this overrepresentation on the field, meaning that Black players are overrepresented with all of these inequalities that come out from play, right? So even if there is the argument that football and sport generally, like especially academics of sport, they often are, or there is an argument that academics of sport will write against, that sport is, you know, this, like, this meritocracy that is a balanced field of play, right? Like, you, as long as you're good, you can make it, right? Like, that's all it is. And if you work hard and if your team wins, usually if your team wins, you know, like, it doesn't always have to win, but, like, if you just work hard enough, you can make it. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think sport is a reflection of pretty much everything else in this country, where that is clearly not true. Because of all of the structural inequalities that are working against people in these arenas, literally and figuratively. And so when all of that happened at the beginning of January with Hamlin's injury, to me it was a representation of all of these bigger issues. You know, not just that there was an athlete that almost died on the field, because like let's recognize that that's a big deal in and of itself, right? That we're watching in real time an athlete have to be resuscitated on the field. So it's not only that, but also how did he get there? How is he now going to be taken care of? How does his age and like where he is in his contract, which is all bureaucratic nonsense, like how does that matter for the situation? How does his position come to matter, right? Like the position that he plays, like all of that I thought that was on full display with those, I don't know, like that hour of TV that was essentially like blank TV because they canceled the game. And so that's what I was trying to speak to. But for me, it all does come back to the experiences of these Black players in the sport.
Well, I have a question. And this is also very interesting. It's all valid points to look into. In my class, I teach sports PR, and we did some interest stories on the different players. And there's a theme that, you know, most of them have played and been the only. And as I was reading the different stories, I heard chips on the shoulders of these lacrosse players. The students couldn't hear it, but I heard it loudly. Mm-hmm. And so one student asked me, who was a lacrosse player, he said, "Why do you say that?" And then I shared with him what I was hearing. And he was like, "Oh," because again, he's in the midst of it and he can't see it. So is anyone doing any type of research on Black lacrosse players?
I'm sure they are. So outside of anthropology, there are tons of people that are sports scholars, right? Like sports studies is a huge field, and you can find people across disciplines that are doing work in sports studies. I don't know of anyone specifically that's doing work like very specifically with Black lacrosse players, because that is like the way that you framed that question is a very anthropological thing to do, right? Like you work with one population for a very long time. And so I can't think of any anthropologists that are doing that. I'm sure people have written about that experience, but I think like more generally, it's probably writing about the experience of being a Black athlete in a predominantly white sport. Right. Like in that,
right.
Whether it's lacrosse, you know, like lacrosse is just one of those sports that a Black athlete might have that experience. And so if you were to broaden the scope of the study, I'm sure there's scholars who are, you know, thinking about what that experience is. But that is the not the opposite experience, but that is just a different framing from the work that I do, because Black players play a predominantly Black sport at this point, you know, like it's majority Black, and it also depends on the level that you're looking at. And so that leads to a very particular experience, right? Like they're not alone. And so that's why my work has gone in the way that it has, because I make arguments about like what it means to be in community with like half of your team in a different way than you are in community with the other half. Right? Like, what does it mean for Black players to recognize similar experiences in each other? Not to say that they don't have relationships with their white teammates or anyone else who might end up on the team, right? But football is usually a pretty Black and white sport, depending on where you're around the country. It doesn't mean that they don't have relationships, good relationships, like strong relationships with white teammates. But I argue that there is something different that's going on between Black players, because they recognize all of this stuff that I'm talking about. They recognize it in each other. Right, like a white player is not going to have the same experience of being followed around a store as a Black player will, even if they are the same size, same position, wear the same like Nike gear that their school has provided for them, right? And so because I work in a sport where there's one, so many people that play, that's something that is different than football or than lacrosse as an example, right? Like football is a sport that has so many players on a team at once. And there's so many different positions, and there's so many different, if we're talking about bodies, like there are different body types that are necessary for the different positions, right? Like an O-lineman usually does not look like a quarterback, who usually does not look like a running back. And so because you have all of that kind of variation that comes up on a team, but it's still demographically the way that it is, like, what are those experiences like? But again, it's the thing that might unite lacrosse and, I don't know, rowing and swimming and, you know, like these fields that are these sports that are often predominantly white at this point, what unites that with football and basketball and perhaps track and field is that, like, usually it's still white coaches, white administrators, white owners, you know, like the people who are making decisions. The administrative levels are usually predominantly white, predominantly male, you know, like even if it is, even if women are playing. And so I think that that is, like, that's the argument around, like, the structure of college sport, right? The structure of sport generally in this country, but also, like, the it's not really global, but the way that we think about sport, right? Like, who's in charge and whose labor is actually being used for the people in charge? And so that same question is asked in lacrosse as it is in football. But I think that if you think about the dynamics of the sports, then that ends up leading to different people that are studying it in different ways.
Well, Doc, we're coming down to the very end, to the wire here. I want everyone to hear the title of your book and when will it be released?
I appreciate that you think it's going to be soon because we are just working away on it. The book is called, tentatively called, Tackling the Everyday, Race, Family, and Nation in Big Time College Football. It's under contract with University of California Press. I am working hard on getting, like, a full draft together now. If you know anything about, like, the academic publishing schedule, it's kind of slow. So I would say, like, give it 2 or 3 years and it'll be out. But as of right now, like,
oh my
the draft
God.
Is on its way. I'll be done with that in the summer. Yeah, I mean, it takes a while for it to go through because of the process of academic publishing, right? Like, you've got reviewers that have to read it. I've got several sets of reviewers that are going to read it. They need the time to read it. They need to get it back to me. I need to edit it. It's got to go through all of these steps before it can even get to say that it's in print. So it'll be a while before it's out, but that's the work that I'm doing now. And even if it's not the book, you know, like, I am writing articles, I am writing these public pieces. So if you see my name, you know, just click on it because it'll be something about this. It just won't be the book.
Well, outstanding. Be ready for me to be in your ear about being a significance of athletics and sports magazine, because I don't think we only need 500 words, and it doesn't take a whole lot of reviewing. It's just you and your review.
Okay.
So
sounds good to me.
Thank you so much for being on Attack in the Garden. Thank you, Jomlin Harrison of Refined Solutions, who serves as our engineer. Join us next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for updates on show guests and podcast follow-ups. Join us on Facebook's A Chat in the Garden with Monique A.J. Smith. And have a significant rest of the day.